Placement. You're no longer the head of psychiatry at the VA in St. Louis. The significance of this lawsuit?
Yes. So Dr. Matthews actually was forced to commence a lawsuit for whistleblowing because after his disclosures, he ostensibly was constructively fired. He was working as the chief of psychiatry. He has an academic position. He's obviously a very accomplished psychiatrist. And after making the disclosures, he was literally required to do comp and pen exams, which is, you know, document review, not as much patient care, and more importantly, very little access to the kinds of information that would facilitate additional disclosures and additional acts of whistleblowing.
And finally, back to Aaron Glantz, the significance of Dr. Joes Matthews coming forward. We just have 10 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just goes to show the issue of accountability, which was front and center in the Phoenix case, is national in scope. And no matter where you work at the VA, it can be difficult to come forward and disclose the issues that are most important to veterans.
We want to thank you all for being with us. Aaron Glantz, congratulations on your Peabody for your reporting on veterans. Dr. Joes Matthews, formerly chief of psychiatry at the VA in St. Louis, and Ariel Solomon, the attorney for Dr. Matthews. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Stowe, Vermont tomorrow night, May 17th at 7 o'clock. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, for information. Democracy Now! Has 3 part-time video news production fellow jobs. Go to our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. Coming to you from Henry Ford College. Yeah, yeah, Henry Ford College. We're still part of the community. Yes, sirree, Bob, but we're also one word less than we were before. And more information about website changes, and I don't know if it's going to be phone number changes or whatever, but all very exciting around here. At least we're going to get some new signage that isn't streaked and corroded and semi-inaccurate. My co-host in the studio is our new WHFR news director, and it's always good to be a new news director rather than an old news director, right? John Conroy, say hello.
Yes, hello, Jay. I'm happy to be the new news director.
That's right. Yeah. And he's not the old news director. He is the new news director here at WHFR, which means he's helping with the journal and maybe even other talk shows and getting guests and so on. You can communicate with John or I at our WHFR email address, WHFR@HFCC. It's still there for the email address, .edu. Okay, so it's whfr@hfcc.edu. Any communications about the journal, just put the name journal in the subject line, and we'll get it within a day or so. And certainly we want to keep correcting things we get wrong, you know, on each week. One of the things I wanted to update immediately is I just found out there was a small story in the Press and Guide. Last couple of weeks we've been talking about the people who will be on the ballot locally for primary races for the August 5th election. That's the primary election. Very important. There's actually some proposals that have to do with money, too. And we'll talk about those. But what I discovered was, in last Sunday's Press and Guide, is that it's possible to withdraw your name from the primary ballot, even though they've said, well, all these people qualify. They had a petition in, and they're valid, and these are the people that are going to be on the ballot. Well, here's the story from Press and Guide. A handful of candidates in primary races affecting downriver communities withdrew from the race after last month's filing deadline. Republican Stephen Farkas is out of the Republican primary in the U.S. House District, that's House 12th District, leaving auto worker Terry Bowman as the lone GOP candidate. So no competition there. Debbie Dingell, wife of retired John Dingell, and Ypsilanti attorney Raymond Mullins are vying for the Democratic nomination. So no change there, though. Belleville resident Alex Price Martell withdrew from the Democratic primary in the 12th State House District, leaving Erica Geis as the lone primary candidate. Geis, by the way, is the wife of Representative David Geis, who cannot run for re-election due to term limits. This is the Michigan. Okay, it's a state House primary, so there's term limits there. So I guess he figured, oh my gosh, to try to fight against a known name, everybody will think it's David again, but in this case, it's his wife, who's probably a wonderful person too, and so on. I don't know, but she is opposed by a GOP member, Kelly Thompson. And as expected, it says, Lamar Lemons pulled his name from the crowded field of Wayne County executive candidates seeking the Democratic nomination. And get this, he was joined a few days later by Inkster Police Chief Hilton Napoleon.
Right.
Okay. 2 weeks ago, I said that H. Napoleon was going to be one of the candidates, and I said, that must be Benny. Benny must be his nickname.
Right.
No, we found out that H stands for Hilton, and he is brother of Benny Napoleon, but he's the current police chief of Inkster. Well, something happened there after I did my correction last Friday, is that H. Napoleon is actually Hilton Napoleon, and it's not Benny, but he is the one that's running. Benny is the current sheriff of Wayne County. So it's interesting if your brother becomes your boss. Is that good or bad? But guess what? For whatever reasons, he's not running now.
There
won't be a Hilton Napoleon on the primary ballot for candidates. So I think the field is down from 8-6. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a horse race.
Yeah.
That's for the executive of Wayne County, including, of course, our current executive, Bob Ficano. He is the incumbent. Okay. I'm sorry. I went on to say the withdrawals cut the field to 11 candidates. So there's more. There's 13 when we started. Okay. I should read the story through first, right? Which still includes incumbent Ficano, former Detroit Police Chief Warren Evans, State Representative Phil Kavanaugh. As I mentioned the name Kavanaugh, he was a mayor back in the 60s of Detroit. So there's a sort of a recognition there. I'm not sure if he's a relative. County Commissioner Kevin McNamara, who is a relative, however, of
Robert McNamara,
who was the one of the previous chief executives of Wayne County. And also, and they're not sure about this, but Westland Mayor William Wild. So Wayne County includes Westland, I guess.
Oh, yes.
It's a big county. Okay.
Yep.
So I guess he's the wild card.
Okay.
Now, he should get a lot of votes in Westland, but, you know, does anybody else know who he is? Anywhere else. And let's see. Incumbent Commissioner Ilona Varga will face only one candidate in her campaign for the Democratic nomination in the 4th District. After Lincoln Park resident Mary Thomas withdrew, Varga, Lincoln Park Democrat, will face Detroiter Lisa Carter in the primary. So that's what we know right now. Just kind of the most interesting thing is Police Chief Hilton Napoleon, after 2 weeks of finally trying to get it right, he's out.
He's gone.
Yeah. But the wild card is in still. Yeah. Okay. So we'll see what happens there. Mentioning that, I'm going to jump to, I do know just off the top of my head, and I mentioned this before, there's an important countywide vote in that primary election about smart buses, the funding of smart buses. Now, these are buses that come when you call them somehow. They're not the regular bus lines. I don't know what the SMART stands for, but it's whatever the acronym is. These are buses that have special routes, and they show up when they get a call. Now, they probably won't pick you up at your house. I'm not sure about that. Any experience, John, with smart buses?
I do not.
Nope, any smart buses run on Gros Isle?
No, they do not.
Probably not. No. Are you in Wayne County?
I am in Wayne County. Okay. We are in Wayne County,
okay.
Yes.
Well, they probably don't want to pay the toll across that one bridge. You know.
We have smart buses in Trenton and other cities nearby.
Yeah. Well, right. And so I think it's a renewal, but it might even be an increase. But if this proposal on the primary ballot fails, I understand it's going to kill smart buses.
Wow.
And we don't have enough good public transportation anyway. I mean, sure, if we had bus lines, one of my favorite cities to visit is Austin, Texas, because they have buses all except for 4 hours in the morning on almost every downtown street. And we're talking about a downtown that I think goes on for about 20 miles. Every street that's not a residential street, every corner, and it cost, well, okay, they just raise it to $1.20 for a whole day's ticket, as much as you want to ride. And it's fantastic. I mean, I've never experienced a bus line in any city that has so many buses, so many hours of the day, and of course, everybody uses them. And it's really good. I wish they were electric buses or something, or diesel, but nonetheless, it's better than everybody driving their cars. And very inexpensive. I don't know any city in the U.S. that has great bus service like that that's so inexpensive. So obviously, guess what? The city, the taxpayers, are paying a little bit extra in their taxes in order to have that kind of bus service. Of course they are, but they want it. It's good for everybody. So we need to keep the, I think, editorial point of view here. What do we say? You remember the disclaimer by now, John?
I'm getting there. You know, I still don't know what this was.
Okay. All the opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of Henry Ford College. There we go.
Especially by the host, yep.
Right. Well, thanks a lot.
Well, I also wanted to make the point, Jay, about the smart buses, on, especially on Grosse Hill. We have a township recreation-owned bus that is driven by a couple people that take care of the township's needs. And it is done cheaper than it would be if we were part of the smart system. There are smart bus systems throughout Trenton and Riverview and other cities, but not on Grosse Hill.
Okay. But you found your own way around. Good. Yep. Excellent. Here's what I saw also in last Sunday's Pressing Guide. Again, on page 14A, so if you get the paper, you can't just read the first couple pages. You know, there might be a really important story on 14A. Well, the second story down is HFCC. Even our PR people can't get the name right. They probably sent it a couple weeks ago before it was official. But we're going to be adding a new certification program. And they got a whole story here about this. And I don't want to insult it because there's jobs there, no doubt. It's called industrial sewing. Industrial sewing. Well, you know, a stitch in time saves nine. So maybe that'll save a few industries. I can't imagine what they do. You control robots that do the sewing? I don't know what. They do not explain what industrial sewing is. But apparently there's jobs there. So we've got a program right here at Henry Ford College in industrial sewing certification. And it's endorsed by about six different groups. Oh, my gosh. The Makers Coalition, Detroit Garment Group Guild, Lear Corporation, don't they make jets?
Yeah.
And Southeast Michigan Community Alliance, Michigan Works.
Lear is a manufacturer of seats and upholstery for cars.
Oh, so they do industrial stitching.
That's a different Lear, yes.
Okay, thank you, John. That's why you're a news director. Yeah. Well, here's a story about the countywide enhanced millage. Okay, and it started with Dearborn Heights. Officials in the Crestwood School District, again, according to the U.S. News and World Report, the best high school district, or it's in the top three of all high schools in the United States, Crestwood.
Oh, that's right. Remember, talked about Crestwood.
Again, one-third of the criteria was how much did they prepare their students for college. And they have pretty much all their seniors taking advanced placement, which really helps to, you know, smooth them right in and give them a head start on college. But nonetheless, Crestwood School District officials are hoping voters will support a countywide school millage. So this will be an additional cost on top of the millage you're already paying to the individual districts. And here's the story. At the recent meeting, the Board of Ed out there in Crestwood, Dearborn Heights, offered its support for a countywide enhanced millage being placed on the August 5th ballot. According to Crestwood Superintendent Laureen Vandenberg, the districts in the county representing 50% of the student population must approve a board resolution in support of the millage if it's to go on the ballot. And apparently there's still time to do so. I mean, the candidates had to have their names in a couple of weeks ago, but I guess other ballot proposals still have a little bit of time. The support of Detroit Public Schools is imperative, and it is supporting the initiative. Okay. The tax levy is 2 mils for 6 years. So whatever that will cost you, relatively small amount. The 2 mils will generate approximately 1.2 million. And I don't understand this because it says Crestwood will receive about 1.4 million annually.
1.4.
So I don't know where the 1.2 million is generated. Is that just 2 mils from Dearborn Heights? Oh my God, that's a lot of money per household. But how can it generate the whole 2 mils generate 1.2 million over the whole county? And then Crestwood gets more than what they even bring in? No, that's wrong. But the extra funding, they said, is very needed because Crestwood's facilities and technology are aging and in need of major upgrades. I think they still have Atari computers over there. Okay, nobody remembers those. The replacement cost for roofs at its buildings, because that could be spent on building improvements too, in fact, is estimated at $3.2 million. So they got some roofs caving in or leaking like a sieve, and they need $3.2 million for that. And so it says, we've patched and patched over the years. We're patching the patches now in numerous locations. So that's bad when you're patching the patches. That's what they're doing to the roads.
Patching the patches.
They're patching the potholes, which are potholes that were there a year ago and getting bigger. And so now, but the patches always seem to sink down. There's a couple of places that are on exit ramps from Southfield Expressway.
Yes.
That I hit. And they've actually filled the potholes like every couple of weeks. But they keep the tar or whatever is declining because yes. They're so deep that the tar starts becoming a pothole of itself. The tar goes down after cars drive over it. So now you've got a pothole that's sort of filled with tar, but it's still chunks your car and messes up suspension or tires or whatever.
As your support keeps dropping,
right? You can't just fix a deep pothole with some tar. I mean, it's temporary, but it's not going to hold at all. And I mean, even before next year, that tar is going to decrease and it's going to make maybe not quite as deep a pothole. But the only way you can fix a deep pothole is to redo the whole road, which means tear it out and put a new road in. Yeah, and that's, of course, $1.2 billion that Governor Snyder asked for in his state address. And, of course, they've only dedicated about $140 million right now, I understand, at the state level. So we're just making potholes less deep right now. And we're not fixing any bridges.
Band-aid approach.
Yep. So we're going to wait for the bridge to collapse until we fix those, I guess.
We don't want to talk like that.
Well, I don't know what else you're going to do. Anyway, so that looks like Crestwood is one of the few districts in Wayne County that does not have a sinking fund, bond, or hold harmless operating millage levied. And I think Dearborn does. In other words, an additional millage to take care of things they need to take care of. I think Dearborn has two or three millages going at the same time for different purposes. Our last millage, they said, out there in Dearborn Heights, was a five-year sinking fund for 1 mil that was approved by our voters in March 2001 and expired in March 2006. So I guess the first question is, before it's on that ballot in August 5th, how many more districts have to approve of it? The districts in the county representing 50% of the student population. So, of course, Detroit has a lot of population.
All right.
But how many more do we have to go? We don't know. Will Dearborn support that or not? See, they've already got enough money from all these millages. It might look bad for them to have it on the ballot, even though it doesn't just go to them. A little bit will go to them, of course, but we don't know about that little detail there. Jody Rampala, love you, Jody. But the 2 mils will generate approximately 1.2 million, and Crestwood will receive about 1.4 million annually. That's impossible, right? You can't give Crestwood alone more money than what's collected either in Dearborn Heights or for Detroit schools or any other schools, because it's got to be countywide that the money would be distributed. I think even if your school district didn't go along with endorsing it. But again, a majority of the student population's school districts have to approve of that in a resolution to be on the ballot. It also doesn't say what the deadline is for that. So some unanswered questions there, but that's why you have this show.
And I would say Also, we got to raise that, and support that sinking fund so that we can get a raise in our roads and bridges.
Is it called a sinking fund at the state level? I don't know what it's called. I think it just comes from the general fund, finally.
Okay.
I don't think there's a roads maintenance fund or anything at the state level. No, the sinking fund is usually used locally for schools. And I should know exactly what they're talking about, but it's some support for things that are sinking. No, it's some support for stuff that's needed.
Yes.
Yeah.
It just sounds appropriate for that.
It sounds appropriate for the pothole repairs.
There you go.
Because they're always sinking, still sinking. Okay, moving on. It's WHFR Journal, the new WHFR Journal, not the same as last week. Jay Koronek and John Conroy here with you today, looking at other stories. Big story is Severstall. Okay. Can you sum it up, John? Severstall has been polluting, and we've been cited 23 times since they came into Dearborn about 8 or 10 years ago, I guess, with their steel plant. And they asked for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ, mm-hmm. Sounds like Dairy Queen, but no, it's the Department of Environmental Quality, to allow them to continue polluting at that level because that's kind of what they've always been doing, and it's not all that bad after all. Nobody's died that they can prove, I guess. So what happened? Update us.
Well, they were issued a new air emissions permit that will hopefully keep them, they'll monitor them closer. There'll be better regulations on what is going to be watched. Doesn't necessarily mean they're not going to continue to pollute. Mm-hmm. But that they will be monitored closer.
Right. We know that a lot of companies don't mind being monitored if they think paying a fine is going to be a lot less than making the change to more efficient operation, less polluting operation. So I'm just saying it's a cost thing. I mean, why did GM not fix that ignition switch? Well, it's only an ignition switch. What the heck? 13 people have died.
13 people.
But it would have cost them so much more than settling these lawsuits, probably. They figured over time, they did this. In fact, it was proven in court. Ford Motor Company, back in the 60s, had an economy car called the Pinto. Mm-hmm. And the hatchback model, just the hatchback model, not the sedan, had a problem with its gas tank placement, which was behind the rear wheel and right behind, immediately behind the bumper. Mm-hmm. Okay? As was discovered after a year or so of these Pinto hatchbacks on the road, and I thought they were really cute, looking, but I didn't have one, but I'm just saying they look cute, this hatchback design. If they got a rear-end collision, the bumper and the chassis would rupture the gas tank, would spray the mist of gasoline throughout the passenger compartment, and any spark in there, like somebody who's smoking, a lot more people used to smoke in those days, or little electrical spark or something from anything, and the whole car would be like a Molotov cocktail bomb.
In flames. Yes.
Because gasoline actually doesn't burn. Did you know that? Doesn't burn.
Right.
But its vapor burns.
Vapor burns.
Yeah. Yes. And of course, the vapor will keep burning and there'll be a big explosion if the gas has been held in like a bottle or a tight compartment. The vapor will become more vapor really quick. But the point is, it's that vapor that ignites, that it's so flammable, and that's what would be caught. So people who knew about this, because Ford said, well, we can't do a recall because that's just the design, can't do it. We didn't know it was going to happen like that. So people used to get bumper stickers for their Ford Pintos hatchbacks saying, don't hit me from behind. I'll blow up in your face. So that's, keeps those people from trailing too close to those Pinto hatchbacks. Well, they found out in court after they did a class action suit, they found the memos, not emails, but printed memos that went between engineers and Ford Motor Company management in the early 60s saying, hey, guess what? These gas tanks, when hit from behind, will probably rupture and cause the whole car to go up in a big bomb. And they found emails from Ford executives saying, well, we'll settle those cases when they come up. It's cheaper than because they'd have to redesign the whole car. Literally, I mean, where are you going to put the gas tank?
Yeah.
You got to put it some other place. Well, that means redesigning the whole car, the chassis, and everything. I mean, that's we'll just settle the few cases if there's any problems. Well, they had I don't know how many people die, but they had people die, and it was but it was finally proven in court. Big settlement. They made a movie. Gene Hackman was in it. It was based on that. They didn't talk about Ford Motors, but it was the same sort of scenario. So I'm just saying, big business, bottom line, you know. So what happened next step, though, even though they've got the permit and the MDEQ says that we're going to monitor you a little more closely, we have two state representatives that got involved.
That's right.
I'll tell that story. Okay. Yeah. Yep. I'm looking at it here in this week's Dearborn Heights Times-Herald. Representatives George Duraney, Democrat Dearborn, and Rashida Tlaib, Democrat Detroit, made the announcement on May 7th, asking for the federal government's Environmental Protection Agency to be involved with this issue. Both representatives said the call for EPA involvement came after, quote, an environmental firm exposed attempts by a local company to avoid complying with air quality standards currently in place. And guess what company that was? Tlaib cited emails that were revealed between the MDEQ and the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, which was set up by the state of Michigan to improve business climate in Michigan. So, if it's bad for business, don't let that happen. So if it's going to cost them more money to not pollute, well, you know, we got to find a way to let them pollute. So they put pressure on, at least a direct recommendation, you've got to let them continue polluting to the degree they already have been.
You've got to.
And forget about those other 23 citations. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem fair. That seems like undue influence from people who have really not the public's interest at heart, but business interest, in other words, profit motive. At heart.
Yep.
At heart. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not saying they're unfeeling people, but that influence seemed unfair. And of course, local representatives, they got quite an earful from people living in Dearborn, particularly in the east side of Dearborn, about not wanting any more pollution or continued pollution that they've been getting from Severstal. And now, this is Koronek's commentary. I don't think anything will be done by the federal government, EPA, to Severstal. I mean, Michigan has already said, MDEQ said, we're going to monitor them more closely. Yeah, but at these higher levels, which they're already, polluting up to.
They're already there.
Yeah, they're higher levels than they were before. And so, but in case the federal government gets involved, well, this just came out yesterday online with thepressandguide.com. It'll be in Sunday's Press and Guide. Severstal may be looking to sell their Dearborn plant.
That's right. Yep.
So that's a way. People are threatening to regulate you, whether it's Michigan or federal government, more closely, just sell it.
Run and hide.
Get the heck out. Yeah. So this is OAO Severstal, which is their complete name, and of course it's a Russian company, said it's considering, quote, a range of strategic options, unquote, for its North American operations, as reported by Crain's Detroit Business magazine, newspaper, whatever it is. However, there's been no confirmation that it will be sold. And Crain says no decision has yet been taken as to which, if any, such option might be pursued. Yeah, right. But, if they're going to be monitored more, if it hurts their bottom line, there you go. Now, somebody said that the bidders for it, yeah, there's bidders already, is Pittsburgh-based U.S. Steel Corporation, whose Michigan facilities are already in Ecorse and River Rouge.
Sure.
So it would just be down the block from them.
Right there.
Wouldn't be a big deal to expand their operations. But Courtney A. Boone, manager of U.S. Steel Corporation's media relations, and this is true of every media relation person, said, we do not comment on rumor or speculation. That's a PR person.
There you go.
No information ever until we're in trouble. I'm sorry. Did I say that?
No.
That's an official email they sent to the Press and Guide. Okay. So Severstal has invested more than $2 billion in assets, have been given, I know it's at least $30 million in tax abatement by the city of Dearborn, if it's not more, maybe it's 60, some astronomical sum of taxes they don't have to pay. So my thought is that's going to expire in a few years. Mm-hmm. And then they got to go to another community that they can blackmail into giving them almost no tax or unfairly low tax situation. That's what I think is going to happen too, besides this close monitoring, which is at a higher level, but still they might get caught going over. Why? Because it's cheaper to pay the fine. Okay.
We're still bringing jobs, keeping jobs in Michigan that way.
Yeah, and it doesn't say, I mean, since there's bidders, U.S. Steel Corporation, there's a big name for you, right? Mm-hmm. And a U.S. company on top of it. Of course, I bet they'll ask for the tax abatement from the city too, of course, before they complete the deal. Nonetheless, I don't see a problem with bringing somebody in as long as they stop the pollution. That's my editorial opinion. And I think it's the people in Dearborn that really care about being as healthy as they possibly can be. Probably agree with me for one of the first times ever. So that's the complete story about Severstal. Several layers there. They've been caught in pollution. They asked for permission to continue polluting and set the level higher for whatever reasons. The Michigan DEQ waffled under pressure from Michigan Business Development Company. But set a tight regulation monitoring, and then our representatives have asked the federal government, the EPA, to get involved in monitoring, and they haven't responded, and I doubt they will. But now Severstal's thinking of maybe leaving. So there you go, because they don't want to lose any money after all. I mean, they come all the way from Russia to make money, right?
Get their money here.
Well, of course. Anywhere. It doesn't matter. International business being what it is. All right. So it's halfway through our hour in New WHFR Journal. We have a couple of comments here from Jim Hightower, which you really should listen to. The first one is entitled, just to whet your appetite. Whet your appetite. Bony fingers versus soft hands. That's right. Bony fingers versus soft hands. And the second commentary is how income inequality actually happens. Wouldn't you love to know? Okay, so listen up here. We'll be back with more of the New WHFR Journal Live, John and myself, right after you get this important information from Jim Hightower.
An old cliche says, hard work always pays off. Really? Ask a farm worker about that, or talk to a McDonald's fry cook working three shifts to piece together an income that still leaves you in poverty. Work your fingers to the bone, goes the old song, and what do you get? Bony fingers. If it's a big payoff you want from a job, go for what my Uncle Emmett called soft hands work. I recommend hedge fund huckstering. These guys, and they're nearly all guys, never get a callus and do nothing of social value, yet they make the biggest haul of anyone. Last year, the 25 highest paid hedge funders raked in a collective $21 billion in personal pay, with half of that grabbed by the top four guys. Their billions are what's called unearned income, money made from money, not from one's labor. And it's not even their money. Other rich people, big pension funds, endowments, etc., entrust them with big piles of their money, which the soft-hand guys then bet on such screwy financial products as packages of subprime mortgage derivatives. Yes, that's the one that crashed our economy in 2008. But even when they bet poorly, the hucksters get richer. For they charge what's called 2 and 20 to get into their casino game. That's 2% off the top of the millions of dollars a person or group turns over to the hedge fund, plus 20% of any profits made from the bets. So a guy like Ray Dalio, who runs the world's biggest hedge game, made a lousy showing for his backers last year, yet he still walked away with $600 million in personal pay. This is Jim Hightower saying, also, to further rig the unearned income game, the hedge crew is lobbying furiously in Washington to let them get away with paying only half the income tax rate that you working stiffs are assessed. Why do we even allow these worthless scoundrels to exist?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Where's Charles Dickens when we need him? The novelist who laid bare the shame of gross income inequality in 19th century England came up with some perfectly fitting names for his fat cat characters, including Scrooge, Mr. Tulkinghorn, Miss Havisham, and Nickleby. So I'm wondering what moniker Dickens would have given to Robert Marcus. He's the CEO of Time Warner Cable, who has just won gold in the Greed Olympics for grabbing the most gold with the least effort in the shortest time. Marcus became chief of the cable company on January 1st, and he immediately reached out to his corporation's biggest rival, Comcast, offering to sell Time Warner to that giant. Only 6 weeks later, the deal was done. Why would a CEO rush to eliminate both his corporation and his own job? Perhaps because of a lucrative little provision in the contract he signed to become Time Warner's honcho. It's a CCC, a change of control clause. This is yet another way for CEOs to feather their own nest, for a CCC hands a big golden parachute to the top executive of a corporation that gets sold. In this case, Robert pockets $80 million. Yes, that's roughly $1.8 million a day for each of about 45 days he worked to sell the company. What we have here is a perverse form of incentive pay for corporate chieftains. Rather than rewarding them for outcompeting their rivals, a CCC encourages them to sidle up to their competitors and whisper, "Psst, want to buy my corporation?" This is Jim Hightower saying, not only did Marcus sell off Time Warner, but his self-serving deal will also sell out untold numbers of its employees who will be made redundant by the merger. We hear about America's widening gap in income inequality, but here we can actually see it widen. One rich man gains an extra $80 million, and hundreds of workers lose their income.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And we're back with the live people. John Conroy and Jay Kornick right here with you on a beautiful Friday in Dearborn. Oh, my goodness. Sun is out there. No rain as yet today, anyway. And so we hope we're going to have a great weekend, folks. Maybe cut the grass for the first time if you haven't already. Okay. Looking at the important stories, let's do some issues coming up. Here's a very important story. The new Dearborn train station, as we call it, intermodal train station, the city has just licensed a food place to
Tim
be there.
Hortons.
Yeah. Now, it's not going to be in the station. They're actually going to build right next to the parking lot, so it's not going to be like embedded in the train station, if you will. But it's going to be a Tim Hortons. So, what do they have, mini bits or something at Tim Hortons that's the inside of the donut holes?
Timbits.
Timbits, that's right, yes. And they're very, very popular. They are the number one coffee and donut place in Canada. They are a Canadian company.
They are a Canadian.
That's right. Unless they were bought by Wendy's. I can't remember.
I don't know.
You know, because near my house on Greenfield in East Dearborn, there is a combined Wendy's and Tim Hortons in the same building.
Well, I see a lot of Tim Hortons.
I think they might be part of the same company now, whether that's a Canadian company or an international company, or I don't know. But
they're certainly part of many gas stations all over the place.
And I wanted to point out, because somebody's going to say, well, they're getting very commercial. You know, why doesn't the city run the facility, you know, and the food if they're trying to make money? Because the city actually has to manage the upkeep on the building. City owns the land, and they've got to manage the upkeep. So they got some cost there. So I thought I would just for a second look at the story, which is 21A. All right. That's way buried here. We're getting close. 22. Oh, I can just feel the excitement. Yeah, here it is. Okay. It's a 20-year revenue contract with Tim Hortons, so it's going to be there a while. And the total amount is $862,000. So divided by 20, $40,000 a year? $4,000 a year? No, $40,000 a year, something like that. Yeah. And it said it should be open by November 2014 if approved. So it's just a couple months after the train station should be taking on passengers there and letting passengers off. And they're going to have a full 1 acre of land adjacent to the station.
Very nice. Yeah.
So 1 acre. Gee, that's going to be a large-sized Tim Hortons unless they have a lot of nice trees and so on. Now, I know they are required by this agreement to build in the same sort of style, architectural style, as the train station. So it's got to be kind of villagey, you know, folksy, friendly, rather than hyper-modern or even the standard Tim Horton look. It says the city was looking for a vendor that provided the type of food desirable to rail passengers. Right. Nothing that's really healthy. Coffee, baked goods, and, well, they have good sandwiches.
Very good sandwiches.
I don't, do they have salads? I'm trying to remember. But, you know, all those donuts, that's not necessarily the best food. But, ooh, food desirable to rail passengers. Yeah, well, nonetheless, it also, the city required them to have a drive-thru, which they thought would be attractive to visitors using the station. I'm trying to figure out, you're a visitor using the station. Oh, you're waiting for a passenger to come in. That's what it is. Or waiting to go out, so you scoot through before you park your car. How far away is this on adjacent land that you've got to use the drive-through if you're already at the station? It doesn't make sense to me, but the city required it, and they went for it.
And the wraps are made with lettuce in them.
Right.
The wraps.
The rent generated from the site will be used to repay the city for the cost of the land, which was $265,000. And what land? The 1 acre? Did they have to buy it from somebody? Did the city have to buy it from, what, the Lincoln Mercury dealer down there, or Lincoln dealer, owned it? I thought they owned all of the train station, but this is land adjacent, so they had to buy it from somebody.
Well, maybe the train company.
No, the train company
Amtrak
didn't own anything there. Okay. Amtrak didn't own anything there. It's all Dearborn land, I thought. But it says here that the city had to pay $265,000 up front. But, of course, the net advantage is they're going to make $600,000more over 20 years. So it'll pay for the land.
Sure.
Plus, it establishes a capital replacement fund to cover the cost of improvements to the station that the station might need over the first 20 years of operation. So that $600,000 divided by 20 is only $30,000 a year to help maintain the station.
Right.
But it's something. It's something. So, of course, it's a monopoly, folks. So not very competitive there. But, again, they did look at several bidders, and Tim Hortons agreed to all this stuff. And so there you go. And the station, again, is expected to be complete in August or so. Now, again, it was expected to be complete last August, 2013. Even this article has still got it wrong or doesn't mention the details. But the station should be open in August or September this year. And Tim Hortons, it'll certainly be open by the time Tim Hortons opens in November, because Tim Hortons wouldn't open without having the station there, I think.
Tim Hortons is a popular place, and it possibly could spawn more development in that area.
Nothing wrong with that. I'm all for a good business moving in there, even if it is fast food, too much sugar. But coffee is getting more healthy, you know, if you read the stories.
Coffee.
No more than 6 cups a day, though, please. But coffee has got phytonutrients. Yeah, so go fight about them.
Phytonutrients.
Yeah, phytonutrients. And even decaf apparently has some of those.
And as good as tea is always made out to be, there's still plenty of caffeine in tea.
There is. It's a slightly different kind of speed, but it's still, there's some in tea, unless you get the decaf kind of tea. Okay, moving on. We've got a lot of it's not a particular event, but it's an ongoing event. The Animal Shelters Raise the Wolf campaign, John. Tell us about it.
Yes, the Raise the Wolf campaign at this point has gotten $2.6 million raised so far. It's got a $5 million goal. And we also heard about the Mutt Strut that raised $100,000.
Yeah, and what's it going to go to?
It is going toward the Dearborn Animal Shelter.
A new building, yes. They're moving from just south of, on Greenfield right now. They're on Greenfield just south of the I-94 overpass, which is also south of Rotunda, the intersection of Greenfield and Rotunda. But you drive south from there on Greenfield and go under I-94. And up on the right, there's the Dearborn Department of Public Works. And then right next to it is the current animal shelter, which is overcrowded, overflowing with pets that need to be adopted. And the place is very well run by the volunteer group, Friends for the Dearborn Animal Shelter. And it looks like they will get some part or all of the land of the old train station location, which is by the Centennial Library and by the police station there and by the center. And as soon as they get enough money to start construction, they've already got plans, I know, drawings and sketches and blueprints done. And so that campaign, folks, is about halfway there, right? There's about another $2 million to go
We're right around half the goal right now. Yes.
So $2 million, that's only 20 mutt struts. So, but we can't wait for the next mutt strut, folks. If you'd like to make a donation, any size, Dearborn Animal Shelter would love to receive that. They have a website. Just put down Dearborn Animal Shelter. You'll get to the website. I'm a regular donor, in fact, because they do such a good job. I love nonprofit volunteer operations in this area, and Dearborn Animal Shelter is definitely one to be supported. And this new facility will be, it is greatly needed, is much needed, and it'll be easier to find. You know, they say location is everything. This is pretty close to the center of a lot of different city activities there, and people can come and visit and adopt and donate, even donating their time to helping with the animals, much easier than the other location, which is not that far away either, but it's kind of by itself down there, and you have to go under the overpass. Ooh, it's scary. No, it isn't. But so we wish them good luck, and it's a great name. They're so clever with their fundraising. Raise the Woof. Raise the Woof. Raise the Roof. Raise the Woof. Campaign. So it's officially started. Please try to make support to help them. The Mutt Strut was very good, but they need another $2 million, okay? So we want to support that in any way we can. Okay, we've got a lot of big things coming up this weekend. John, why don't you talk about the home tour tomorrow?
Yes. We are looking forward to the annual spring event with the Friends of the Dearborn Symphony. Have their 33rd annual home tour from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. tomorrow, Saturday, May 17th. And they've picked the Dearborn Park and Dearborn Hills neighborhood directly across Outer Drive from Dearborn High School. Six houses in the upscale neighborhood, some call an eclectic mix of Tudor, Colonial, Art Deco, and Cape Cod designs will be open for viewing on tour day. Tour headquarters is the Dearborn Country Club, which is at 800 North Military. Lunches will be available at the DCC, as will vendors with craft tables, as well as the annual Symphony Jewelry Booth will be available. And best free parking is available at Christ Episcopal Church. And buses will be able to transport folks, tour goers, to the neighborhood.
Yeah, that sounds like a great activity. So it's $15 if you get a ticket in advance, and that means today, or $20 tomorrow. And the meeting place tomorrow is at the Episcopal Church in West Dearborn, right?
Yes, Christ yes, Episcopal Church.
Christ Episcopal yep. Church. That's just off Military.
Yes, 120 right. North Military.
Yeah, it's easy to find there. It's just a little bit east, a little bit whatever, north of Michigan Avenue. And probably can get the tickets there. And I used to live in a neighborhood in West Dearborn that was sort of a historic Ford home district. And we had one of those home tours in our district, not coming through my house, no thank you, but through other houses from the 1920s. Those were built by Henry Ford I for his corporate executives so they could live nearby. Wow. He started one of the first subdivisions in the whole United States of America, in addition to many other things that he's known for, both good and bad. But nonetheless, so the home tour is always fun. People love to be nosy and look at other people's houses and decorations and their landscaping. Probably not a lot of flowers out yet, but they're starting. You know, it's been pretty cold so far. So that's a great fundraising cause and a lot of fun. Get a little walk in if it's sunny, and I think it's predicted to be at least no rain anyway for Saturday. So it'd be nice to do with the family. You can dress up a little bit and walk around a couple of those neighborhoods. And again, they say there's a bus that will take you from the Christ Episcopal Church in West Dearborn to the neighborhood and bring you back. So there's free parking there around the church, and not in the city, but in West Dearborn, but around the church. And so you get a bus from there, and they'll drop you off in the neighborhood, give you a little map, and then you can be nosy.
It should be in the mid-60s tomorrow as well, so it should be good walking weather.
Yep.
Also, and checks, if you make checks ahead of time or even during so, they should be made out to the Dearborn Symphony.
There's a lot of businesses where you can get the tickets in advance today if you're really out and about today. I know it's almost 2 o'clock, but still.
There are.
Just a few. Mention a few in Dearborn.
Yes. Campbell's Paint and Wallpaper on 904 Mason. Mm-hmm. The Dearborn Symphony Office, 23400 Michigan Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
English Gardens, 22650 Ford Road. Mayor Diane Politko's office, 6045 Fenton.
Oh, she's got an office. Good for her.
Sure.
Okay. Well, that just gives you an idea. Or you can get them tomorrow at $20 a person at the Christ Episcopal Church. So good fundraising for the Dearborn Symphony, another great volunteer organization that always has a lot of fundraising activities. Why? Because you have to. I mean, you can't survive on no money at all. You know, it's thanks to our generous donors during our radiothon, we have two brand new audio consoles. And I'm looking at one right now. Retail value, about $5,000 each. Boy, do we get a deal. Our general manager, Susan McGraw, really knows how to negotiate.
There you go.
And we've replaced both broken and half-broken consoles that we had. And so we're on the air because of your generous support. And we'll let you know when the next thing blows up. Okay. Hopefully not soon, but because we don't want to take any money that we don't desperately need. But a lot of these organizations, like for the animals and for the symphony, really, they are supported by these events. They can't. They're not extra. They're not optional. Okay. I wanted to mention about the Farmers and Artisans Market on Sunday. It's going to be indoors. For the last time, you know, their special third Sunday, well, this is may or may not be a third Sunday, but they already had a Sunday, May 4th, indoors at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. And this Sunday, May 18th, they're going to be there open from noon to 5. I think in the past it was 11 to 4. I really think the other ones were 11 to 4. Anyway, noon to 5 this Sunday, May 18th, and it's free to get in. And look at the vendors, look at the food, look at the flowers, whatever they're happening to be presenting there. Their outdoor season begins May 30th, Friday, May 30th, their regular Fridays, and that goes through October 17th, closed on July 4th, by the way, at the Bryant Public Library parking lot in West Dearborn. And Fridays are going to be from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. When you're outdoors. But this Sunday, May 18th, at the center, noon to 5 p.m. So check that out. I bet there's going to be flowers and some vendors that you'll see more of outside. Tomorrow, I believe, is the big flower day at the Eastern Market.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also, well, and flowers are coming out pretty well. We went on Mother's Day to Schwartz's greenhouse downriver, and they were flowers galore, and shoppers galore, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Too.
Yeah. Well, it's. We'd like to have a little bit more warmth, but nonetheless, it's getting just a few sunny days. That's all we'd like to ask for. Okay, and want to do this one?
Sure.
Okay. Last chance, folks, to comment on the fiscal year 2014-2015 budget in the city of Dearborn.
Yes, we have important dates include the public hearing on the budget, which is scheduled for this coming Tuesday, 6:30 p.m. in the City Council chambers. The public's invited to give comments and ask questions about the proposed budget of this hearing. And then the City Council is scheduled to adopt the proposed budget at a public meeting at 6:30 on Thursday, May 22nd. So you want to get in there this Tuesday make your feelings known.
Right. And you can look at that budget. I know it's a, I think, about a 60-page document. Don't want to scare anybody away, but you can look at it and you can read closely. Maybe you've just got questions about some of the details in there. I certainly do. That's on the website, cityofdearborn.org. Somewhere you'll find a file. You can download it probably showing this whole proposed budget. There have been workshops, one or two a week for the last 3 or 4 weeks on individual issues where they would explain. I'm sure a lot of concerned citizens attended some of those that were appropriate to their issues. In any event, the last chance to make comments is Tuesday at 6:30 at the City Council Chambers. Okay? The other issue is they're going to vote on it and probably approve it. Maybe they'll make a modification, but it's just 2 days later, next Thursday, there's going to be a City Council meeting, which are normally on Tuesdays, by the way. But special meeting, I think so. People won't realize there's a meeting and nobody will show up because, well, they showed up on Tuesday, but let's not worry about the real thing where they're actually going to vote on it. You don't want any catcalls from the audience while you're approving it. I don't know. It just seems very strange that they're doing it this way, that there's public comments, but then they're actually going to take the vote, yay or nay, at a time when most people normally wouldn't expect a meeting. I mean, it's been proposed, I mean, advertised for months. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, they told everybody it's going to be that Thursday. So, but and I think at this point, if they don't know your comment by now, it's probably not going to make any difference to them. But show up anyway. Take a listen. Okay. Last but not least, Gary Warrenchuk is there again.
This is our senior citizen conference. It's going to be held Wednesday, June the 4th, 7:45 in the morning to 12:30. At the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. And this is open to residents of Allen Park and Dearborn, who will turn at least age 60 this year. There'll be a sign-in registration where donuts and coffee will help you stay healthy and welcoming from the various dignitaries. And then the speakers and presentations on interesting and important topics, including public safety and legal aid for seniors, recreational and travel programs, and speaker Chuck Gatica from Channel 4. Mm-hmm. And then lunch will be provided at 11:45. And as are most of these events, there'll be health screening happening, blood pressure checks, information tables, and door prizes, and probably raffles as well.
Okay. Fun time will be had by all. Yes, and it's free, but you do have to register by May 28th.
Yes.
And there's three ways to do it. Maybe you can mention those.
Yeah, by mail, you fill out the form, clip it, put it in an envelope, and mail it to Commissioner Gary Warrenchuk.
Well, yeah, because everybody who's registered, who has a household, a registered voter, whatever, in Dearborn and Allen Park, Gary's district, should have gotten this in the mail in the last day or two.
Well, he's at 500 Griswold, 7th floor, Detroit, Michigan.
Oh, just stop by his office.
48226. We know where he is.
Okay.
And by fax, fill out the form and fax this page to 313-967-6940. Or by email, you can email the information from the form to gworonch@waynecounty.com. Or by phone, you can call 313-224-0934 to register by phone.
Yeah, that's probably easiest out of all of those to remember, folks. You can just, again, you can look up Gary Warrenchuk. That's Warrenchuk, at the Wayne County Commission office. He is the head commissioner, chair, whatever. And his office can just take down your information over the phone. That would be the quickest. So any seniors, and you mentioned you have to be a senior of 60 years old or older. Mm-hmm. 60. So 59 and a half is not good enough. Sorry.
Let's turn 60 okay. This year. Yep.
AARP lets you join at American Association of Retired Persons at 50. So
and read up in the magazine what to look forward to.
A lot of senior discounts. You have to be 65, though.
That's true.
Oh, well, do the best you can there. I still have a few stories. We have just a couple minutes, though, before 2 o'clock, and we hope to have Highway 61 with Joanne Kay coming in at 2 o'clock or about, and doing 4 hours of the best in blues, local blues, regional blues, fantastic thing. Oh, yes. And I don't want WDET to beat us to the punch here, but honest folks, nobody at the Arab National Museum, Arab American National Museum, let's get that right, sent us the email about this yet. It's called Yalla Eat, which they say is Arabic for let's go eat. So I'm not sure if Yalla, Y-A-L-L-A, means just let's go, and then eat is Our eat the same as Arabic eat? Do we all have the same language when it comes to eat? Well, I don't understand, but I don't understand a lot of things. Anyway, the event is called Yala Eat Culinary Walking Tours. It's a great idea. Unique culinary experience being offered by the Arab American National Museum. Through a guided walking tour along Warren Avenue in East Dearborn, participants will learn how Arab Americans began to revitalize the shopping district in the early 1980s, turning vacant storefronts into a thriving cultural retail designation. Participants will also explore the diverse current offerings of Arab and Middle Eastern food businesses along Warren Avenue. Admission is free, but online registration is required. And you can go to their website for that. And of course, I printed it out from their website, but the website address is not here. Arab American National Museum, probably AANM.org. That might get you there. And of course, you could probably call them. They want you to do it by email anyway. All tours begin at 2 p.m. and run approximately 2 hours. Comfortable walking shoes required. No sandals, nope. Sorry. Start, finish is at Super Greenland Market on Warren Avenue, West Warren. But you need to register first. They do have some openings on Tuesday, May 27th. Not Saturday, May 31st. That's filled. Again, Tuesday, June 3rd, June 7th, and so on. We'll put this information in our copy notebook here at our main studio so that the other DJs can be mentioning this as dates get close. So that's the Arab American National Museum Culinary Walking Tours. And I assume they'll probably have some samples of free food along the way. But, yeah, you know, certainly you can buy anything you want to as you're walking along there. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I'm sort of surprised that the Arab American Chamber of Commerce, which I think is their name, didn't come up with this idea. Sounds like a good alternative to do regularly for tourists and even people of this area.
Certainly.
Be a lot of fun to do that for people that don't know the wide variety of stores and even food that's in this area. When I heard the story on WDET this morning, they pointed out, you know, there's Pakistani restaurants, there's Lebanese restaurants, and several other nationalities that have food that's unique to their home nation that they serve, and it's not very much Americanized. One woman who was being interviewed said, well, the presentation is Americanized. And I'm just wondering about that. Standard American-sized dinner plates? Or I don't know what they mean. The presentation is Americanized. I mean, do you eat out of bowls with your fingers? No insult intended there. But I'm just saying I don't know what they mean by Americanized dining. But whatever. It's... You know, the food is very authentic and different than you'll find probably anywhere else in the United States because it's very authentic in terms of what they serve in the home country, too. So have fun with that. Yala Beat Culinary Walking Tours, a project of the Arab American National Museum here in Dearborn. Okay. Let me see. What else can we toss in here, John? Okay. Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay, final little commentary here as Joanne is coming into the studio. This is WHFR Dearborn, people. This is a short editorial from the New York Times from yesterday, Thursday, May 15th. Nicholas Kristof talks about the Canadian dream. So to all of our listeners in Windsor, this is in tribute to you and your country. Nicholas says, it was in 1931 that the historian James Truslow Adams coined the phrase,